Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose-Levy, and we're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a journalist of health, food, and the environment for over two decades, reporting on Alternate, The Huffington Post, EcoWatch, Intent.com, and What Doctors Don't Tell You. I'm also a media advocate for a whole range of beneficial causes and organizations to better our health, our environment, and our society. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between the personal health that we and our families experience and what's going on in the total health environment. Many people just feel that it's enough to take care of their personal health, their mind, their mental well-being. And, of course, that's a great place to begin with health. As the first phase of the health revolution had us doing over the last 30 years, and I was part of that from very early on. But the next phase is really we need to take care of the social vectors and infrastructures in our society, because as we seek health, they undermine it, and we allow it and kind of assume that things are okay. Today's show will be our third in the series discussing Trans-Pacific Partnership, as well as trade deals in particular, and we'll be talking and honing in a little more today on fracking with a special guest, David S. Levine, who's a legal expert and specialist in all of this, and thinking long and hard about what these large trade deals mean for our democracy, our ability to self-determine around healthy food and environment and clean water and air, and, you know, the business goals of large multinational corporations. That's what we're going to be discussing on today's show. So welcome, David, to Connect the Dots. So happy to have you here.
I appreciate it.
we've had a couple of attempts to get David on the show, and in fact, we spoke earlier when I was hosting the Lifeboat Hour a couple of weeks back and substituting. If people enjoy today's program, which we're going to hone in a little bit more specifically on certain topics, but if you'd like to hear more, you can also reference back on PRN to the Lifeboat Hour, and you'll find the show that we did in archives. An interesting thing that I just want to begin the show with, David, is I was talking with somebody recently who is very part of the slow food movement, a really terrific foodie, someone who really helps people eat and grow healthy foods and understand what those are, who's thought long and hard and taught many, many people the cooking skills and the gardening skills, and has been very active in the slow food movement and also in the movement to label GMOs. Mm-hmm. And so we were having breakfast the other day, this friend and I, and I mentioned that I have this upcoming show with you and have been doing a month of coverage, really, on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and other trade agreements, which we'll discuss today. And she had never heard of the TPP. This is someone who's kind of an activist and organizer, very dedicated to health, one of the most, and not just her personal health, but her whole business, vocation, and offering in life is really focused around this. And I said I had been doing this coverage of the TPP, and she'd never heard of it. And she said, "Well, what is it?" I said, "Well, it's kind of an uber structure of international trade law that, for one thing, people have to kind of hypothesize about what it is, because apart from some leaked documents, the nature of these agreements, have not been made public and may pass into law, before being made fully public. And yet those agreements and those laws could supersede, and there's reason to think that some of them might, local laws, state laws, all the kinds of initiatives and laws and protective legislation and regulation and everything that all the groups that I cover regularly here and know and work with, have been concerned to engage people about. And so here is someone who's really active on the food front, never heard of the TPP, completely unaware that, a lot of the kinds of legislation and regulation that we seek for the sake of health could just be sort of overridden by a multinational treaty and trade agreement. And I think that's, you know, the reason I bring this up is also because I've written a kind of big picture book about health. And I'd love to hear from listeners as well as to, you know, your interest in looking at a big picture, because what tends to happen is everyone looks at their niche, and it's hard to kind of get your mind around the overall. And I think maybe we can be specialists in our individual niches, but it's important as citizens to kind of look at the overall, or we'll miss something like this, like the fact that you're working to label GMOs, and, you know, something is coming in from a completely other direction that you're not aware of that could undermine your efforts. So in light of that, I just want to ask you, before we get more in depth on the topic, how much do you feel, David, in your lecturing and advocacy and all the rest of it, are people really aware of the TPP?
That's the average person. Right. That's a great question, Allison. And your friend shouldn't feel too bad, because my experience with discussing this issue, and I've been focusing on international trade issues, primarily on the technology and intellectual property side, now for about 5 years. And I will tell you that it is still the case that a majority of people that are otherwise, at least in my experience, otherwise well-informed, even in, as you point out, their niche areas, are not at all familiar with trade agreements generally being involved and impacting their issues, or that there are actual agreements being negotiated at that moment that are, in fact, impacting it. By way of one example, a couple of years ago now, I did a presentation to a large group of intellectual property law scholars. Again, these you know, sharp, active people, and in a room of about 45, 50 professors, only two were aware of these agreements. Now, that was a few years ago, and the number has certainly gone up, but it's still not regular, everyday conversation. And there are two real reasons for that, I think, because I've given a lot of thought to why it is that we don't know. One is obvious, and one's not so obvious. The obvious one is that these agreements, particularly the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which are both potentially impacting the issues you've raised, have been negotiated largely in secret, with very little information being made public. In the case of TPP and TTIP, no draft texts are available, so the public doesn't know exactly what language is being negotiated and what international laws and rules are being negotiated. And so therefore, it's hard to really have a sense of what's happening without that raw data. So that's the obvious reason, and I'm happy to go into more detail there. The less obvious one is that trade generally is not an area that has been thought to encompass such wide-ranging issues. Right? So you mentioned the issue of GMOs, right? And how would it be that GMO labeling would come up in a trade agreement? And the way it comes up is not at all obvious, but it comes up in what are generally known as non-tariff barriers to trade. So in other words, which is part of it, the other reason, the second reason, is that this is very arcane, very technical, often very dry stuff, although, as you point out, extremely important. These barriers, like labeling, could be actions that corporations would be able to seek recovery for having to do. And again, that is the kind of issue. You say, well, how is that trade? And that's a very good question. How is it trade? And yet it's being negotiated through trade. So the obvious reason is that it is literally done largely in secret. And an obvious reason is that you wouldn't necessarily think of trade as impacting these things.
It's almost like trade becomes the ultimate measure or highest level of value. So in other words, if there's a potential health risk or health harm to any substance or practice, you know, that is of a intrinsically lower consideration with these kinds of international deals being negotiated at a, you know, an extra beyond national level. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's almost as if those become lower considerations, and trade benefit, you know, becomes sort of predetermined as a superseding goal. Now, we know we live, you know, in a capitalist economic society and all the rest of it, but this seems to take it to a new level. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that?
Sure.
How that can happen.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So let me focus on TPP for mm-hmm. a moment. That's further along, and I'll mention TTIP after. So mm-hmm. for listeners that aren't familiar, the TTP is a trade agreement that the United States has been negotiating with several countries for the last 3 or so years. Those other countries, because it's trans-Pacific, right now are throughout the Asia-Pacific region. So Brunei, Australia, Chile, Japan. So again, this goes into South America as well. Malaysia, New Zealand, Singapore, Vietnam. Also countries like Mexico and Canada are part of it. And what the agreement is designed to be, according to the U.S. Trade Representative, who is the office that represents the United States in these negotiations, it is an agreement that is designed to create jobs, right? It's designed to increase trade among these countries and increase access to technology and to other services and goods in our trading partners, okay? And all of that, right, it sounds fine, right? I mean, you know, unless one is opposed to trade generally, and certainly that's a view as well, the notion that the United States would have a trade agreement with trading partners that would make things better for everyone, right, sounds pretty good. But when you dig a little deeper, what the TTP is much, much more than trade. Historically, the U.S. Trade Representative has handled agreements that have generally been bilateral, meaning the U.S. and another country, or maybe a few countries, and they've been relatively narrow topics. So you have a free trade agreement with a individual country. You have an agreement with regard to a certain good or service being traded, but you don't have a wide-ranging agreement that covers a variety of areas. And to be clear, right, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, again, emphasizing that the text is not public, okay, is not public, has over 20 chapters, and these chapters run from environmental to intellectual property to investment rules and on down the list. And so these topics are all falling under that broad rubric of trade, and in a sense, right, of course, they do impact trade, right? The United States clearly exports tons of intellectual property, right? And so that is a trade issue. But of course, the challenge becomes that we're not just talking about how many CDs, right, are going to be traded between the United States and Vietnam, but we're also talking about rules regarding access to that information. What is piracy? What does infringement look like? Who will have access to information? And in fact, what winds up happening is these trade agreements are not just about goods moving between geographical boundaries, but they're ultimately about who's going to be liable for what. And once that happens, it becomes much more than just trade, right? Even on the energy side, right, you have issues where, and we'll talk about fracking domestically a little later, but you have issues involving whether the United States is going to encourage this technology to be used in its trading partners, and particularly in TTIP, but also whether our trading partners are going to encourage us to engage in fracking. And so trade agreements suddenly become issues that are not just about whether we're going to have natural gas energy, but whether we're going to have potentially earthquakes, or whether we're going to have water being contaminated, or whether we're going to have gas being leaked into the atmosphere. And so again, we call that trade under this rubric, but in fact, it's much broader than that. And what winds up happening is, right, getting back to your first question, Allison, because it's so important, is that all of this looks very arcane and very technical and very not part of what I need to worry about. And what I've been saying to people over the last 6 months or so, and it's parroting from Larry Lessig at Harvard, who's been focusing, as many of your listeners probably know, on campaign finance reform issues, Larry put it brilliantly with regard to why the public should care about campaign finance. And I've parroted the same idea with regard to these issues of trade and transparency. And what he wrote, and this was in a piece in The Atlantic that I recommend highly, and it was at the beginning of this year. He said, it's not that, and I'm paraphrasing, it's not that campaign finance is the most important issue, but it's the first issue. And it's first because you will not get what you want in policy, right, in Congress, in your elected officials, right, without first addressing this procedural problem of, in that case, right, the chokehold of money on elected officials. So too, right, if we are interested in having international rules, which do and potentially would have the impact of forcing signatory countries to change their domestic laws, right, to have that impact, then we need to care about how these laws and regulations and agreements are being negotiated. So we have to care about who has access to what information. We have to care about that overused phrase of how the sausage is made. Because if we don't focus on these procedural issues, then the substance becomes imbalanced and skewed. And that's effectively what's happened, if you'd like me to talk about it, in terms of on the ground, who has access to what information.
Yes, do talk about that.
Yeah. So here's the real rub, right? So when I say that there is secrecy, it is true. The secrecy, however, runs to the public and to those who are not, and this is in the U.S., identified as cleared advisors by the U.S. Trade Representative. So what I just said again, we're going right back into, right? Your listeners think, oh my God, now I have to understand how the United States negotiates trade agreements, right? Let me change the channel, right? And before you do that, right, and hopefully you don't because this is critical stuff, you need to understand that there are certain entities that, in fact, do have access to information about these trade agreements, do have access to the negotiating text, do have access to the positions that the United States is taking in these agreements. In the case of intellectual property and technology, which is my primary focus, the two industries that are, in fact, generally cleared advisors by the U.S. Trade Representative are the entertainment industry and the pharmaceutical industry. So when we're talking about issues like access to generic medicines, which is a patents question, right? When a medicine loses its patent protection, then other manufacturers can create that same medicine much more cheaply, and therefore more people in the world, right, have access to that medicine. We are talking about the pharmaceutical industry having access to the information it needs in order to give input and feedback to the U.S. Trade Representative, and not any other groups, right? Not doctors, not patient advocates, not civil society groups. With regard to intellectual property, right? My primary focus, right? You've got issues involving questions like who is going to be liable for piracy and what means are industry going to have to combat it. So the entertainment industry, right? Understandably, although I think it's very short-sighted, on their part, want to have the strongest possible weapons that would exist in the law to go after pirates, right? The question no longer becomes whether piracy or infringement is bad, because while I am a big fan of balanced copyright law, I also firmly believe that if someone takes an MP3 or a recording and copies it verbatim and doesn't pay for it, that's infringement, and it should be actionable, and it should be punishable. But how far that law goes, right? How much of a punishment there will be, what kinds of damages will be awarded, who's going to be liable for it, is an area where there is enormous debate inside the intellectual property world. However, with regard to the input that the U.S. Trade Representative gets, the only groups that are allowed to offer meaningful input, meaning they know exactly what's being discussed, is the entertainment industry. There is no access on the part of the public. There's no access, again, on the part of civil society groups. There's no access on the part of groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others that have different views from the entertainment industry. And so what winds up happening is you get imbalanced law, not just because the public doesn't have access, but because only certain industries and interests that have an interest in the law have the information they need. And I will tell you that I am not of the view that we need to have transparency about everything as soon as negotiations begin. Because, in fact, we know quite well that if you're going to negotiate any kind of agreement, there needs to be some amount of discretion, some amount of secrecy. However, after 20 rounds of negotiation of the TPP, okay, 20 rounds meaning there have been 20 meetings over a period of days in each meeting where negotiators from all of these countries sit down and go line by line through these agreements and horse trade, it is well past the time where the U.S. Trade Representative, I think, can defensively argue that to release the text, and this is their argument, to release the text would kill the negotiations because discretion wouldn't be available and because the public pressure would be too great and so forth. Even granting that there might be a place for that, in other words, negotiators need to have the ability early on to put out a variety of positions to get a sense of where people stand, we are well past that time. And so what's wound up happening is you've got public secrecy, you've got entertainment and pharmaceutical access, right? And this can only lead in one direction, creating people like me who are otherwise not, again, not really opposed to trade agreements generally, concluding that this agreement probably, when it is finally made public, and by the time it is made public, it will be too late in all likelihood to change it, right, to be supported.
Mm-hmm. How do these certain industries get privileged access and, you know, these and not others? How does that happen?
So it happens through an administrative process at the U.S. Trade Representative. And the U.S. Trade Representative, and I'll explain it this way, the U.S. Trade Representative was designed to represent the United States' interest in trade. And that has generally been synonymous with industry's interest, okay? Which is, again, not surprising. So the U.S. Trade Representative wasn't really designed, and this is part of the problem, to deal with these issues. Margo Kaminsky, who was at Yale, wrote a terrific article about this this year where she focused on these administrative questions. And what winds up happening is the U.S. Trade Representative, conceiving its role as representing industry in trade, then creates an advisory process which only calls on industry input. And in some industries, that makes sense, right? If we're talking about tobacco trade, putting aside the health issues, which are significant, right? But putting aside those issues, the primary interest would be, well, you know, as long as people are going to engage in this behavior, healthy or not, right? The U.S. position is, you know, we'll sell tobacco and we'll buy tobacco and so forth. And so there's limited public input that might be needed in an area like that. But in other areas, like what I've mentioned, the impact of these issues are far more broad. But the U.S. Trade Representative doesn't conceive and has not built an advisory system that way. The way that this system works is through what are known as Industry Trade Advisory Councils, or committees, which is the acronym being ITACs. And there are ITACs for a variety of areas that are subject to trade. The ITAC, for example, that deals with intellectual property is an ITAC created by the USTR, and the USTR decides whom to invite. And so they invite the entertainment industry and the pharmaceutical industry, and that's as simple as that. That's how it happens. Now, interestingly, so that's the administrative answer, but what's happening now? A few months ago, I think reacting to public pressure brought by a variety of individuals and entities, the U.S. Trade Representative announced the creation of what they called a Public Interest Trade Advisory Council, or what quickly became known as a PTAC, P-I-T-A-C. And this advisory council was designed to have some access, and again, without going too far into the weeds, although I've gone pretty far already, there are levels of access even within these ITACs. We'll put that aside for a moment. This PTAC was designed to be, at some level, a counterweight to the IP ITAC and the other ITACs that are generally dominated by industry interests, and was open to civil society groups and others. As it stands today, and this was a few months ago, I have not seen any public announcements to any of the questions with regard to it. As far as I know, the committee hasn't been formed. I will tell you that I applied to be on the committee, and it wasn't clear that I even met the eligibility requirements, but I applied. I have not even gotten an acknowledgement that my application was received, although I believe it was. So I don't really know what's happening there. But at least it suggests the possibility that the U.S. Trade Representative is becoming more interested in these issues of information access. The U.S. Trade Representative also has created, in the last several rounds of the TPP, what are known as stakeholder sessions. And these stakeholder sessions are designed to allow anyone who applies to have a few minutes, generally it's been about 8 to 10 minutes, to address any negotiators that are around during various rounds. So a few weeks ago, for example, the fifth round of the TTIP was being negotiated in Arlington, Virginia, and I and many other people representing groups came up to Arlington or down Arlington to do talks. Now, here's the interesting thing, okay? Your listeners might think, well, wait a minute, Levine, right? You had the opportunity to do a talk, so isn't that transparency and input? And I will say, to be fair, yes, it's certainly better than not being able to say anything in a formal session. However, I don't have access to negotiating texts. I don't have access to position papers. So when you have these stakeholder sessions, and they're optional in terms of whether the negotiators actually attend, although at the last round of TTIP there was pretty good attendance, you don't know whether anything you're saying, right, is in fact going to be accurate. And so what winds up happening is, and this is the amazing thing, we fall back on, right, old Washington lawmaking methods. And so undoubtedly there are private conversations, and there are leaks, and there are informal discussions and so forth. All of the stuff that happens, right, leaking, lobbying discussions, outside of any formal transparency, and therefore you have the backdoor negotiating happening across the board, right? And so to the extent that there have been leaks, and there have been leaks out of TTP, not of TTIP yet, or at least nothing significant, they've come literally from WikiLeaks and from Julian Assange's organization, which boggles my mind as well. So, because it winds up happening, Allison, I don't mean, and I'm a bit on a pulpit here, but I think it's so critical. I personally cannot fathom why the U.S. Trade Representative would cede the ability to decide when and how to release information to WikiLeaks. Okay, even if, right, you want trade agreements to happen, the notion that you are, because leaks are going to happen, right? I think certainly Edward Snowden and the NSA affair has indicated that the notion that the government can hold on to secrets is waning rapidly, right, with the advent of technology. Assuming that you're not going to live in a fantasy world, right, the notion that the U.S. Trade Representative would decide, you know what, we're going to hold on to this information as long as we possibly can until such time, and it's going to happen, that Julian Assange gets access to information, and then Julian, right, will be the person deciding when transparency happens and how, is just mind-blowing to me. It's bizarre, it's counterproductive, and I just don't get it, which is why the argument I've been making to the U.S. Trade Representative now for a couple of years is, look at your own interests. Forget mine. Forget my interest in balanced law, right? Let's assume you actually want to do what you want to do and have an agreement. You're not, this system is not working for you.
And, you know, is there any reply to that? Is that kind of like, I guess I see what you mean?
Well, I'll tell you this. The answer generally is no. The most formal reply that I've received, a couple of years ago, Sean Flynn, who's at American, and by the way, your listeners may also want to know where could you find out more, and I will tell you first and foremost, American University's PGIP program, which is the program that they have on intellectual property and information justice. They have a website called infojustice.org, infojustice.org. Sean Flynn, who runs that program, and Chris Sprigman, who's at Virginia, and I had written a letter to the U.S. Trade Representative calling for transparency in TPP. And to make a long story short, what we received was a written formal reply basically saying, and this was from the former U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk, we are transparent. And we're transparent because we have stakeholder sessions and so forth, not really addressing the issue of access to negotiating texts. So the formal response has really been talking past each other. Informally, you know, I will tell you I don't know what to make of the fact that I've not received much of a response. Is it because I'm being ignored? That's certainly possible. Is it because there are internal discussions, ironically, that are happening about this issue? I'd like to hope that that's the case. But other than actions, and I'm happy to see actions, I certainly don't need anyone, you know, emailing me or calling and saying, great job, Dave, or whatever. I couldn't care less about that. To the extent I've seen actions happening, again, perhaps the best response I've seen to indicate that there might be a crack is at least the announcement of the formation of the PTAC. Whether that happens at all, it remains to be seen.
That they announced that they were doing it represents a step forward?
To be clear, I guess I have to remember, I'm in this upside-down world where it wouldn't be evident to people who aren't paying attention how that's progress. To the extent that you want to look for positive signs, right, certainly that's positive. And remember something else about this, right? This whole area of transparency is fraught with ambiguity. The talk that I did at TTIP, the point I wanted to make to negotiators, which I hopefully made, was that, first of all, we don't know what we mean when we use the word transparency, right? Because the U.S. Trade Representative would say that they're transparent, and their definition of transparent might be an organization is transparent where it allows the public to talk to it. And certainly they do that, right? They allow you to talk to it. My definition of transparency might be deeper. It includes access to actual information. But the point is this. When we use words where there isn't an general understanding of what the word means, the result is everyone has an out, right? I can say they're not transparent based upon my definition. The USTR can say that they are transparent based upon theirs, and we get nowhere. So we need to, and this is part of the work I'm doing, to think about ways that we could discuss this issue where we can all at least agree about what we're talking about.
That sounds great. Now, we are up to the time for our station identification break. So stay with us, listeners. We'll be back in a few minutes talking with David Levine about the fascinating implications of these trade agreements on our lives and their kind of arcane way they function, which we discussed in the first half of the show. In the second half, we're going to be zeroing in a bit on fracking, which I know will be of interest to many of you. So please stay with us for the second half of the show. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, back with you again. Today, we're talking with David S. Levine, Associate Professor of Law at Elon University and an Affiliate Scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. He's been telling us about trade agreements, the TPP and others, and how the transparency, lack of transparency, and ways that those are coming about could have long-ranging effects that we need to be more aware of. This is the third in three programs that I've had over the month of May and now into June on this. If you are interested in more background and different takes on this, we also have a program with labor expert Stan Sorcher, as well as physician Margaret Flowers talking about net neutrality, internet neutrality, which was recently redubbed by John Oliver, Don't Let Them Screw Up the Internet. And that's also something that you should be very much aware of and take action on, because of the very program that we're coming to you on, as well as the many advocacy initiatives that I regularly cover and draw your attention to here on Connect the Dots, are all impacted by these larger policy and legal frameworks that we're discussing today with David Levine. I also want to mention, if you're just tuning into the show, please, you can find it later today in archives, and you can go back to listen to the first half. If you've enjoyed the program, please like us on iTunes and share it with other people. You can also get more news and information by following some of the links that David spoke about earlier and which he'll be talking about again on this show. You can also follow overall links to all of the programs and the issues I cover at my website, healthjournalistblog.com, as well as on Facebook, Connecting the Dots for Health. So here in the second half of the show, we're going to focus a little bit on a topic that I've covered since 2009, and I know if any audience is well educated to this topic, it's folks here that listen regularly to Connect the Dots, and that is fracking. I'd love, David, I know you've taken a special interest in this area as well, and I'd love to hear, you know, one of the things, back in 2009 when I first began covering fracking, you basically couldn't explain fracking without bringing up the Halliburton loophole and explaining how this process had been exempted from a whole, almost all of the major environmental protection laws. And so there we have a prime example of how whether, you know, a process is included under legal and environmental health protections or kind of allowed to roam free, as we've kind of had with fracking, what a huge, huge difference that would make. And I remember I wrote article after blog after blog after blog. I was basically the first news cycle reporter covering this issue because most people just thought it was like a maybe good for one article, and it has practically become an industry. It's so complex and widespread and interactive in terms of all the areas it touches and how it evolves and the places that it goes. But I remember at a certain point in raising public and media awareness when other people suddenly began talking about the Halliburton loophole, which is the, you know, way that this process was exempted. I was like, oh my God, Rachel Maddow's talking about the Halliburton loophole. All these other, you know, The Atlantic is talking about it and Seeing Progress cropped up. They're talking about it. And suddenly I was kind of like, well, we've certainly done that media awareness job here. Up until now, and I've talked with and interviewed on this program and elsewhere many, many people and all different kinds of expertise about fracking and its ramifications, I don't think I've talked to anyone yet, excepting some kind of off the radio program conversation that you and I had briefly, David, about the trade and legal agreement dimension to this. So I'm going to be, you know, fascinated along with our listeners to hear your insights on that.
So, thanks, Allison. This is another critical issue. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, my area of expertise is intellectual property law, or at least it's one of them. I am not an environmental law expert, nor am I a chemical engineer, nor am I an engineer. So my entree into the issue of the regulation of fracking came through a broader concern that I have with regard to the ability of commercial law to control access to information by the public. And at front and center in the fracking world, and I appreciate you reminding me about the depth of knowledge of your audience, so I can skip a lot of the stuff about fracking that you and certainly probably many of your listeners know better than I do, right? The nexus between fracking and my area of expertise comes in this doctrine called trade secrecy. Now, trade secrecy is one of the four only intellectual property law doctrines, right? The others being copyright, trademark, and patents. And what a trade secret is literally information that would be valuable to a competitor because it is not generally known, right? So the classic trade secret is the formula for Coca-Cola, right? Another example, by the way, speaking of food and health, would be the recipe for KFC, right, and their chicken, okay, which is also a trade secret. So we're dealing with commercial information. But what winds up happening with commercial law doctrines is, and particularly trade secrecy, is what I think is very disturbing and very problematic. Trade secrecy is designed to create incentives for commercial entities to create new and better goods and services, right? So the idea would be that Coca-Cola has a trade secret, and by virtue of being able to keep that information secret and sue a competitor for stealing that information, they will continue to sell Coca-Cola, and that's a good thing, right? Now, again, it's funny to say that, of course, on a health show. I'm not advocating now that people drink Coca-Cola, but the point is that it's something which is new and innovative and therefore useful. And in the absence of trade secrecy, Coca-Cola wouldn't have the incentive to create that formula, or they'd have to look at another doctrine. However, right, when it comes to access to information, trade secrecy becomes very pernicious and far more powerful than any other intellectual property law doctrine to prevent access to information. So what's happened in the regulation of fracking is that the companies that create the chemicals that go into the ground for fracking, right, and of course it is Halliburton and a few others, have claimed that the formula of the chemicals that they use to engage in hydraulic fracturing is a trade secret. Now, for many of your listeners, what I'm about to say is going to be frightening because they're right. it is a trade secret, at least we can assume that it very well may be under U.S. law, okay? Under the Uniform Trade Secret Act, which is the law that most states have enacted, it is likely that that formula is a trade secret, so long as it is commercially valuable and secret, okay? And it would appear to be that. But what's the result of calling it a trade secret? The result of calling it a trade secret is manifest in the fact that the public will not have access to that formula absent an exemption or a change in the law. Why? Trade secrets, first of all, are generally exempted from freedom of information laws, right, both at the federal and at the state level. And the reason for that is again, a good one, right? Generally speaking, if the government is going to request that a regulated industry share information so that the government can do its job, right, industry shouldn't therefore have to give up all of their rights to compete in the market, right? And we can imagine what would happen there, right? If every time the government asked for information from industry, right, and said, and all the information you share is public, right, it would be impossible for the government to regulate anything because industry wouldn't comply, and we'd lead to a chaotic situation, right? Now, again, you know, put aside for the moment the issues of capture and the question of whether the government itself is actually regulating as opposed to working to support the industries that it's supposed to regulate and supervise. Let's put that reality aside for a moment and focus on the law. So there's a good reason to have trade secret exemptions. But the problem becomes, and this has been my focus, what we do when the trade secret is information that the public has a strong interest in knowing, right? What do I mean? We, the public, don't need really to know what the formula is for Coca-Cola, right? It's well established that it exists, that it's not killing people, at least directly, although again, right, there's plenty of evidence suggesting you shouldn't drink soda. But again, the point being, we don't really need access to that formula. However, when you're dealing with issues like hydraulic fracturing, right, and all the environmental health and safety risks that, again, you and your listeners know better than I do, there becomes a strong public interest in making sure that we know that, in fact, it's safe, that it's not going to create environmental harms and health harms and so forth. And that work cannot be done, or at least so I understand it from talking to scientists and reading scientific journals, without knowing the exact concentration of the many chemicals that go into fracking. But because of trade secret law, the result has been that, in fact, that information is not available to the public. And the chemical industry has been very effective in every state where regulations are being written to argue at a minimum that the public shouldn't have access to that formula. And oftentimes, they've been able to limit even regulatory access to that information. So by way of disclosure, I'm a member of the North Carolina Mining and Energy Commission's Trade Secret Study Group. I was asked to join that group by the chairman of the commission who wanted input on what trade secret law should look like. And my role there has been to advocate for North Carolina to be not in the realm of the other states and take more seriously the notion that the public has the right to that information. I'm sorry to say that that has not been the direction that the state appears to be going, because the law that recently came out of the legislature makes it a misdemeanor for the public to access this information. Now, whether the regulations coming out of the Mining and Energy Commission can militate some of that harm remains to be seen. But be that as it may, I have been pushing heavily for a public interest exception, or at least having the ability for the public to get access to this information. And to me, the ability of the Mining and Energy Commission to have that information should be low-hanging fruit and really nothing that requires discussion, and yet there's been a challenge to that as well. So the way this comes up at the end of the day is that you've got an intellectual property law doctrine called trade secrecy, which, again, to be clear, serves very valuable purposes in intellectual property law, right? It is not a doctrine that should be thrown out. However, in the case of public interest in information and access to information, it actually operates in a very, I think, bad way in terms of access information. It operates in a counterproductive way in terms of how democracy should operate, and therefore becomes a problem that requires addressing, because it moves beyond fracking. The code inside voting machines that allows a voting machine to tally your vote correctly is a trade secret. The information inside, and this is an amazing thing, the formula used for lethal injections – okay, in the United States to handle the death penalty is a trade secret. And so there have been questions regarding whether, in fact, that information can be accessed to deal with the constitutional question of cruel and unusual punishment. The code inside breathalyzer machines that are used by police officers, right, to determine whether on the side of a road a motorist is, in fact, driving while intoxicated is also a trade secret. And so courts have had to step in to actually allow defendants to see in very closed rooms, right, and confidentially what that source code is in order to determine whether, in fact, their clients are going to go to jail or not. And trade secret law has the power as it stands today, and I can talk to you about how it should change, but the nutshell is, has the power today to stand up against constitutional issues involving speech, access to information, cruel and unusual punishment, the right to a defense, and win the battle. And so it's a very powerful law that requires a lot of changing and thought, and this has been my primary focus in my scholarship and my advocacy for 8 years.
Wow. So, you know, what you're saying, and I actually could see this applying in a lot of areas beyond fracking, there's kind of a fine line. You know, I understand what you're saying, too. There has to be some way to protect some of this information. But then it can, you know, how do you get the right balance is really the question. Because, you know, I'm also thinking of the fact, like, you know, for example, there are many chemicals used in consumer care products, personal care products, all kinds of things. And, you know, a lot of that is just kind of sort of presented through a general description rather than being detailed, you know, due to it's being stated that these are, you know, proprietary in some kind of way. And then the end result is people don't really know what they're being exposed to. I think obviously the most egregious example would be fracking chemicals, but even, you know, the perfume mix, that, you know, rather than listing what the ingredients are, it just may say perfume in a body care product. And for people who are chemically sensitive, of which there is, you know, an increasing number, you know, knowing more specifics could really be useful. I mean, of course, they can just try to avoid everything under the sun, which is what a lot of people do, but it just seems like people have to dance around a whole lot. Where is the right balance and how does that get achieved?
Well, that of course is the $64,000 question because it's very complex. You know, it as you indicate, it's not simply the solution is not simply say no trade secrets. But the solution is also clearly not in what we're doing now. In other words, the freedom of information laws are in my view way too solicitous and way too imbalanced in favor of commercial secrecy. So this is a lot of the work that I'm doing now in terms of solutions. But I'll offer a couple, and I'll key them particularly to fracking. You know, one way that this can be approached, I think, from a regulatory standpoint, is in the kinds of causes of action that exist when you access a trade secret. So the traditional situation where you have what's called trade secret misappropriation is the situation involving the departing employee. Right, so someone, you know, employee leaves a company, has trade secret information, right? Let's just use the fracking example, right? Has the formula used by X company for fracking, goes to that company's competitor and shares the formula with the competitor. That's trade secret misappropriation. That's actionable. That can be punished, right? But let's take the scenario that we are concerned about here, right? Let's say that I'm just picking one out of thin air, right? Let's say the Sierra Club, right, wants access to the formula, right, for fracking, right, in a given state by a given company in order to assess the EHS harms that might exist, right? That is very different than a competitor getting access to the information, right? Unless the Sierra Club, and you want to talk about an upside-down world, is going to enter the hydraulic fracturing world itself, right? Their reason for accessing the information is to confirm that it's safe. And to me, you could create exceptions there where the Sierra Club has access to the information in order to do all the testing that it needs to do, subject to the fact that if it turns out that the Sierra Club, right, winds up sharing the information in a way that would have to be defined that would lead to an anti-competitive situation, right, which would be difficult to conceive, there might be a limited cause of action, right? Or there, we might say, well, that doesn't change the trade secret protection that you have. Now, that's not a perfect solution, right? because this is a really challenging issue. But that's one possibility. The other possibility is some kind of escrow. In other words, the trade secret information is held by a third-party panel of experts or group or scientists, right, in this case, that would have the ability to do that testing, right, confidentially and independently confirm whether it's safe or not. Those are two possible solutions. But let me suggest the third, which I think is more far-reaching and I think particularly relevant here. There are areas where we might say that trade secret law is simply not the right doctrine to use to protect that information. And so we might have an exception that says, right, where you have information that falls into this broad general concern about public health, public safety, and so forth, that trade secret law is simply not available to you. In other words, you have to go the patent route. And keep in mind, by the way, that patents are public. Once you have a patent that is issued by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, it is a public document. Okay, you get a monopoly over that information. In other words, no one else can create what you've patented, but you can look at it and figure it out and understand what it is. So where you have something like the formula for fracking, we might want to say that that isn't a trade secret. Keeping all the other trade secrets that don't have that same public impact and public concern intact. So one of the projects I'm working on is to look at, and I'll spare your listeners the theoretical discussion of this, but suffice to say, to look at the question of how the information is actually being used, and based upon how the information is being used by a competitor versus by a public interest group, and tailor the law and the remedies accordingly. Here's my point, Allison, which is very important, because many of your listeners, even those that are well-educated on this issue, might say, oh my God, this is too complicated, or more realistically, the politics of the situation are such that this is never going to change. And I will tell you, based upon my own personal experience, that I don't believe that to be the case, and it's not pie in the sky. Okay, we're recording this show, right, the morning after Congressman Cantor, right, in the Richmond area was defeated, right, in a primary.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Here's an interesting thing to think about, and I don't know a lot about the Tea Party challenger who won, but if you look at some of the Tea Party messages that come out, those Tea Party messages are often, right, anti-corporate control of information, anti-Wall Street, and I'm using all of these cliches, but the point is that some of the Tea Party members are not all that far from many of your listeners in terms of questions like access to information. And so what I'm suggesting is this, right? Not that we're all going to hold hands and everyone's going to agree, but that on these kinds of issues, where we're talking about control of information by corporate entities, which is exactly what we're talking about here, I would suggest to your listeners, who I'm assuming many of whom are not Tea Party members, right, that there will be areas where groups who otherwise disagree can agree on these questions. And I think one of those issues is starting to become this question of trade secrecy and the ability of commercial law to prevent the public to know what industry is doing. And so while I'm not suggesting, therefore, that this is going to change tomorrow, and like I said, I say this with immense sadness that North Carolina appears to be becoming not the most open, but the least open state in the country with regard to this information, right? But I am also not of the view that this is a lost cause. Precisely because trade secret law is not well understood, shows like yours, and thank you for discussing this issue, thank you for all the work you've done on it, before I have, right, and thank you for being willing to dive into it. The more that the public understands what's going on here, the more there will be the opportunity to find those elected officials and regulators who are sympathetic, and I think there are, again, more who are sympathetic on this issue than might be evident based upon how legislatures go, right, to address these issues. Because it is a broader issue than fracking when we talk about commercial control of data and information. And in the absence of having access to information, it will be impossible for us to make good public policy decisions on anything, because the interests that want to make as much money as possible on that information will do exactly that to the detrimental effect of the public and competitors and everyone else.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So, I mean, you're saying that a partisan focus could potentially work. I mean, that's an interesting, tantalizing thought. It could be more complicated than it looks.
Yes.
One thing I would certainly argue for when you were using the You know, the Sierra Club is an example. You know, I would argue that physicians and healthcare practitioners treating people reporting symptoms and ailments would also, you know, be completely free and have the information necessary to address the exposures that people experiencing health issues in the aftermath
of the crisis.
That's right.
And Allison, to jump in on that quickly on that point, right? Because I don't have a utopian view of this, but there is an example of where these coalitions came together, and it was a few years ago on the efforts to kill the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA and PIPA, which some of your listeners may be familiar with. But if you're not, this, and I'll make this very short because I know we're short on time, this was a bill that came right out of the entertainment industry to make all kinds of activity illegal that otherwise shouldn't be illegal. Here's my point. When you look at how that bill was killed, and it was killed in Congress in the face of significant support by, to be clear, Democratic members who work with the entertainment industry, it was because of coalitions. It was because that there were people on our political right and left working together to convince enough, right, policymakers that there wasn't the support in any particular contingency for what this was doing. And so, I'm not suggesting this is easy, and we are in very early days, but throwing up our hands and saying it can't be done, I think, is exactly what we shouldn't be doing. And quite frankly, again, you look at this defeat of Cantor last night, right, and look at the person who won and match up his views on access information from what I understand of them, and it's still early. I haven't read all of them, but what I understand of them and what I'm talking about, and you're going to see more similarity than not, and to be clear, I am not a Tea Party member.
Well, you know, thank you for these, you know, very interesting perspectives. David Levine, we're coming to the end of this edition of Connect the Dots, so thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you know, check out the show that we did together, which also, you know, went into depth in certain other ranges of these issues on the Lifeboat Hour. And, you know, check out some of David's blog writings on what is the name of the place that you are they can view your blogs?
I'm going to suggest two things. First, infojustice.org, and also I've written some pieces for Slate, so you can find stuff there. And you can also, if you really want to get into weeds, go to ssrn.com. That's a social science research network. Search my name, and you'll find my law review articles if you really have a lot of time and really want to dig deep. And I don't know if you'll enjoy it, but you can read them.
Thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, for being with us this week on Connect the Dots. We'll be back again in another week. We're going to be talking about women writers and how to support women's writing with the head of She Writes a week from today. So have a great week, everyone, and thank you for being with us on Connect the Dots. We'll be back again 10 a.m. Wednesday Eastern Time a week from today.